And you're listening to WMFO 91.5 FM, Tufts Free Forum, commercial free, community based radio. And today your host will be myself, Jeff, with
Diego.
Diego back after a long absence, getting a new job and surviving,
taking care of mom,
all the good stuff capitalism brings our way. So today, you know, we got a lot of stuff to talk about. One of those teachable moments, as they say, about in the West Coast on Seattle, where Shama Sawad, social alternative member and Seattle City Councilor, elected two times to Seattle City Council now, led a movement to bring a modest tax. We nicknamed it the Amazon tax. Amazon's the big, huge corporation in Seattle, but there are others as well. A modest tax on the biggest corporations in Seattle to pay for, if the tax came in, to pay for things related to homelessness and the housing crisis in Seattle. It's the third largest homelessness population in the country, not at all the third largest city.
Was the second is San Francisco, or?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think it's New York and San Francisco in that order, but I'm not sure. So, basically, the housing crisis is acute. We've already won through Shama's leadership and the social alternative helping out there. Won money for housing, but it's not nearly enough. And this tax passed overwhelmingly. We'll get into the details. That was a struggle in itself. That required a lot of mobilization of people on the street and into City Hall and so on. And but the tax passed and was ready to put in about $49 million per year into housing services for homeless people and building low-income housing or public housing. And that was ready to go, all set to go, and all of a sudden it got torpedoed at the last minute based on enormous pressure by Amazon. And this tax would have not hurt them at all. Not that I care if they had to take lower profits, you know, for a while. And we're going to get into that story. That's a teachable moment I was referring to. And we'll talk about other things today as well. So if you just tuned in.
I prefer them to have no profits.
I know, exactly. I mean, this is it's all sort of transitional, as we say.
They already have enough profits.
Exactly.
Jeez,
exactly.
How much do you need?
Exactly. Well,
how many homes can you have?
What we're going to talk about today, I hope, if we have time and so on, and if we remember, is we just have to really stress.
Remember George Carlin? I was watching George Carlin. They don't get an F about you. They don't get an imp about you. They don't get an F about you.
They don't. But I wanted to get into this whole thing about tax increases or wage increases with unionization or whatever, somehow preventing companies from existing. Oh, they have to go out of business. They have to lay people off. They have to do this and that. It's all lies, man. It's all lies. And we'll get into why that is. I mean, basically, I'll give you a hint. In case you don't understand or have been taught this or you just want to ignore it, there's no such thing as a static corporate profit pie. You know, there's no such thing as a static corporate profit, rate of profit, or aggregate profits. They change. And why do they change? Well, costs increase. Oh, guess what? There are costs that have nothing to do with wages. You know, there are costs in raw materials. There are costs in the CEOs want a bigger raise.
Yeah. You know? And now with the trade wars with China.
Yeah, costs and tariffs.
You know,
stuff like that. But these costs are eaten up by the company when they're non-wage costs, especially non-wage costs from the workers, not the CEOs and so on. The companies regularly eat these costs and just say it's the cost of doing business. And their profits rise and fall based on these. Like right now, every human being, every worker is facing higher gas prices, really crippling higher gas prices, by the way. That could be the Achilles heel of the Trump administration, by the way. Increased gas prices, increased heating oil, but also oil is used in so many products as a lubricant, as a fuel source, as all sorts of, it goes into production of plastics. Oil is just everywhere. So if the price of oil goes up, inflation goes up, the companies start charging more money in order to make up for that inflated cost. And they just say, well, that's an inflated cost. They don't go around, you know, trying to shut down the oil companies. You know what I mean? They don't go around, you know, they want subsidies and stuff, but they don't treat it the same way as they would a tax increase or a wage increase from workers in a union or workers unionizing or whatever. And that's and you know, we'll get more into that, but that's basically, you know, there's some costs they consider legitimate, others they don't, and that's just completely arbitrary, and they know they can screw with workers more and use their propaganda of the corporate media and so on to hurt workers, hurt unions, drive down wages through fear and coercion and terror and propaganda, get workers themselves to think, I can't ask for a wage increase or I'll lose my job, which is untrue.
Yep.
Companies often shut down.
That's what happened in Whole Foods.
Yeah.
Well, people like, oh, don't ask for it. Sure enough, people start getting laid off. If you're making 15
didn't matter.
Up, bye.
Didn't matter.
Come back next year.
Yep.
Next year, gobbled up by Amazon.
Yep. And the thing is that cost, whether it's increased raw materials or whatever that don't have to do with wages, like I said, the big businesses will just consider those sort of natural costs, whereas wages they know they can screw with in so many ways. Even if they don't lower wages, even if they don't lay people off, they can make people work faster. So we're producing more. It's happening in my workplace. We got fewer workers producing more, but our wages aren't going up in any appreciable way. And we're in a union environment, too, but the union is unfortunately in bed with management and doesn't want to really take on Harvard the way they should and get us real substantial wage increases.
Are you guys overstaffed or?
Understaffed, severely understaffed.
Same with the hospital. The nurses do 16-hour shifts.
Wow.
So, I'm at the cafeteria, horrible. And I'm like, I didn't just see you today. Yeah, I'm here for another 16 hours. Don't rub it in my face.
Oh my God.
I get that. I like the job because I get to see the hidden, because she's a nurse. She's well off. No, not necessarily.
They work hard
overworked,
for that.
Overworked. Yep. Under-rested, you know?
Yep. And there's something that could help cure that right now. Coming up this fall, I don't know if you heard about this.
Yeah.
A safe patient staffing ratio, and I could be screwing up the language on that, safe patient nurse staffing ratio. It just means as it sounds.
More nurses.
Having enough nurses, a certain number of nurses, less, more than now, for patients, especially patients in ICUs, in acute care units or intensive care units. And, of course, big business is fighting this. The big hospitals, which are now mostly for profit, are fighting this with huge lies. I'm not sure they're mostly for profit, but they are profit making, even if they're considered nonprofit. And these are huge lies, that they're putting out in the media. I've seen these ads on YouTube. They're ridiculously stupid ads. But people are at the mercy of corporate propaganda because we don't have our own media, obviously. We don't even have a workers' party in this country that can put out significant media. And that is a big problem. I just wanted to choose a song here.
Well, that's
for
like
later.
When I went to the hospital in Cuba, you had more nurses, more doctors, more of this. It was different.
Yep. And the fall,
and all the patients had their needs met, right away, like immediately. None of this. Wait. We'll wait till you have a heart attack, and then maybe.
If they don't find some way to get this legally off the referendum, off the ballot line, off the ballot, or whatever you want to call it, in the fall, if big business doesn't find, if the corporations don't find some way to screw this over legally, we will be able to vote on that. But there'll be a ton of propaganda confusing people,
Just like the school question.
Yeah, but the school question last time, in Massachusetts, for our international or national listeners in Massachusetts a couple of years ago, I might have the chronology slightly off. There was this amazing, in my opinion,
charter
vote.
School.
Yep. Because there's a lot of support for giving public money to private companies to run schools now in the United States. That's called charter schools for short, which is a misleading name. It should just say giving our tax money to big businesses to make even more profit and then to control the situation. So public schools have a lot of rules and regulations, which are quite good, actually, in most cases, for access. You have to accept all students, regardless of their
race
or wealth,
ethnic,
or disabilities,
religion,
or whatever. A charter school can choose to pick who they want, and the charter school gets money, tax money, even though it's a private business.
So we're
it's
going
like
backwards.
You're giving,
to,
totally backwards.
You're the gentry. You're white folks. Yeah, we want you only. No, we'll have less just to keep the quotas.
The United States is headed backwards in so many ways so fast. Not that it reached a very progressive point. You know, we're talking about going from bad to worse in the United States in terms of social welfare, in terms of education. I hear these people talking. I mean, I understand the impulse. A lot of progressives, or some progressives, will say, hey, it's a great education system, because they want to defend public education by saying it's not completely horrible. And I understand that, but it's bad enough that I think there's a better way to face that problem and admit that there are problems, but their problems are because of underfunding. The last figure I found on federal money to public schools was only 8% of the public schools' budgets. It should be 100. I mean, the federal government should be the only funding source, except for maybe donations, to public schools. There should be no property taxes going to public education. That's a recipe for inequality, and that's where we're living that hell right now. The basing schools school funding on property taxes, primarily in the United States, in many places, is placing the burden on homeowners or renter. Well, do renters pay property tax? No, they don't. But on homeowners, and therefore, if you want to gentrify,
renters become homeless when the rent goes up.
That's right. Yeah, if they can't afford. Yeah. But what I was going to say was if they jack up the property taxes over time enough, and I've seen this happen, they gentrify towns and communities and small cities. They gentrify them that way
because you can't afford the taxes anymore. Now forget it.
Yep. Yeah,
and my rent just went up $150 this year. That's why I needed to move on.
Yeah. And that's multiple reasons. That's not just
According to the landlord, you know, the cost of the maintenance cost, or what they call it, the property taxes and stuff like that.
Yeah, and going up. And some of that might be true, but it's completely arbitrary where you end up with a rent increase like that. Yeah. And there used to be rent control in Cambridge. And I remember that fight really, really well, and all the propaganda against it. I don't want to get into that right now. But maybe we get back to that teachable moment of Amazon. So let me just read from an article. There's a new issue of, this is the center pages of a new issue of Socialist Alternative, issue number 44, June 2018. Now, this came out just before, as I'll explain, there was a quick coup by big business and their Democratic Party allies to overturn what was a victory. Now, this is an article by Calvin Priest and Keeley Mullen. It actually was in Counterpunch at counterpunch.org, and now in this print edition and on the web edition of Socialist Alternative, the newspaper of Socialist Alternative. So anyway, it says before it was repealed, which I'll explain what happened, tax passes in Seattle, and the billionaire class fights back. So tax Amazon passes in Seattle. On May 14th, about a month ago, the Seattle City Council passed a historic tax on Amazon and other big corporations to fund permanently affordable, publicly owned housing under the leadership of Socialist Alternative, Democratic Socialists of America, and Socialist City Council member Shama Sawant. So, not quoting, just from what I know of this, Socialist Alternative initiated this. It comes on the heels of other victories that we've had in Seattle by basically mobilizing people, basically by starting coalitions around issues and then bringing as many people as we can out into the streets and into City Hall. And believe me, the Democrats and there's no Republicans in power in Seattle, but the Democrats and the establishment, the big businesses and so on, they just despise the way we organize. They hate it. A lot of progressive, so-called progressive Democrats will mouth things about, like Sanders, get in the streets, organize in the streets, blah, 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 and then they don't do it. And when we do it, they actually don't like it, because it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing to have protesters at your door.
We learn from the best, Bill Hayes and the rest.
Well, it's embarrassing to have, city council filled with hundreds of people. Every time a big issue comes up in Seattle, they actually have a place for public to be at. Are you okay with that?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm having trouble hearing you actually say something.
I just switched it up. Sorry.
So.
All right. Good.
All right. So if you haven't been, if our mics weren't working properly, are you on mic 4 now?
Yeah, I'm still on mic 4.
There you go. Now I hear you better. So this is Diego. Maybe they didn't hear your intro. Diego has been away for a while, so we had a little catch up there. You probably heard a sort of an echo in the background. But
this thing, the wires are gone, and they put Instead of getting a new one, it's, geez, I don't know.
You're okay now?
Yeah, I'm good.
All right, great. Yeah, I can hear you much better. Okay, so.
I'm on, Tufts. You got enough money. Get new headphones.
So, so the in Seattle, the way we organize is to mobilize people, and it works. It really does work. It's a lot of it's labor intensive. You knock yourself out. You sacrifice your time and your energy and your money and so on, but it does work as a way of organizing. And so they're trying everything they can. They've tried everything they can. They had the Democrats when Sharma first got elected, and I think it was 2013 or 14. The Democrat, and we won the, and right after that, we did a big campaign to win $15 minimum wage in Seattle, and that passed. It was the first city in the country that passed a $15 minimum wage law. The Democrats got together with Republicans in the legislature, and they wanted to, I mean, in a, you know, judgeships and all that, and they wanted to sue, they wanted to shut down, I think it was through a lawsuit, but I'm not sure about that, I have to double check that, but they wanted to shut down legally through the court system. This big Seattle City Council chambers where you can bring people in and you for public hearings and public meetings and stuff like that. And they just wanted to say that was somehow illegal. And word got out they were doing that.
Backfired.
Well, it totally backfired, because imagine having your elected representatives, so-called, and the people behind the scenes that are, you know, the great Oz's behind the scenes there pulling the strings. Imagine that it gets out that they say, oh, the public can't show up to its own city hall. It can't show up to its own city council meetings. It can't protest. It can't have meetings. It just was totally against any kind of mythology about democracy you want to have, you know? And what happened was it got so embarrassing, it never actually went to the courts. They stopped it. And then you know, in Sharma's reelection campaign, they fought hard to not get her elected. Put a lot of money into her opponent's campaign, corporate money. Sharma and Social Alternative candidates don't accept any corporate money, and we run and serve on a worker's wage. So we had a lot of financial hurdles to overcome, but we overcame them through getting small donations, and we won the re-election. And immediately went into, after we had the $15 an hour minimum wage victory, we then were working on, we stopped a police new police headquarters from being built. And now, not coincidentally, there are cops suing Sharma personally, because they're saying defamation because she called them murderers when they actually murdered an unarmed suspect, you know, in one of these waves of police shootings. So they're suing Sharma. And there's ways to, by the way, if you want to donate money to the to Sharma's campaign, there's ways to do that. I forget the website, just Google Sharma Sawant, and I think that's Kshama and Sawant, and I think you'll find what you need. And if not, get in touch with socialalternative.org, and we can point you to the campaign. It's an independent campaign. We're not actually running it to raise money for court costs for Sharma. The thing is that we won that, and we won money, tens of millions of dollars. I think it was $45 million or something. Instead of going into this, building this new cop shop, this new palace for the police, we got that money to go to housing issues, you know, housing services. And I'm not sure if it went to building low-income housing or not, but I think it did. So here's the problem, though. It wasn't enough, obviously, and the fight continued. We were fighting for rent control. We're fighting for all sorts of housing issues. We won on another housing issue. Landlords have to make certain repairs before they raise rents. The main slumlord that we fought against was Hoagland, and the law became known as Hoagland's Law. So he sued Sharma also, but a court ruled against him and said, sorry, that, you know, you are, they didn't say you are a slumlord, but they said that through the campaign, your name became public domain, basically, you know. Sorry, you know, you can't.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah.
And then he lost. He's probably appealing.
He turned like Casper.
Can you imagine? And this, of course, was a great victory for the people, not just Sharma. And it helps low-income renters not having to live in squalor in Seattle. Of course, all these laws have to be enforced and stuff. We don't have any illusions in big business, corporate democracy solving everything through electoral means, but you do what you can. And it has had a good effect and won and made activists really strong in Seattle on housing issues. It was a strong housing movement, which led to the next wave, which was an occupation of City Hall at one point and a lot of protests in the streets and filling up city council chambers. And all that led to the Tax Amazon victory, which I'll get back to this article for a second. Again, I'm reading from Tax Amazon Passes in Seattle. This was written, this is the June edition. So it was written in late May, June edition of Socialist Alternative. Now, things have changed since then, which we're going to get into in a minute, but you have to understand how this was done and how it was organized, because it was a temporary victory and can be done again, and it has spread to other cities, like in Silicon Valley in California. They want to tax, you know, Google and all that, which I can't wait, man. I hope that goes through. Anyway, so this was initiated by Socialist Alternative, led by Socialist Alternative and Democratic Socialist of America and Social City Councilor member Shama Sawant, turned into a big campaign, coalition of housing groups and so on. And the final bill, a $48 million annual tax on the biggest 3% of corporations in Seattle. It's only 3% of the biggest corporations. This was the end result of a powerful campaign by housing activists and socialists over the last 9 months. Now, in the 9 months sounds like a long time, but I remember, like, this happened quick. You know, 9 months, I guess, in my time frame as I get older is yeah, very quick. Yeah. And so it was a very concentrated campaign, very good campaign.
It's almost 2020. Jeez. A lot of time flies. I remember, like, 2000s was just, like, yesterday for me. Now
yeah. Imagine when it gets to 2020. That's going to freak me out. Like you're saying, it's just going to, like, I'm going to be like, wait, this is science fiction. I hope I make it. But anyway, anyway, what we won, even though it was substantially reduced, and this is important under big business pressure and Amazon's extortionary threat to take away jobs, is nonetheless a major victory and inspiring example for workers around the country, especially when it comes as it comes alongside Trump's corporate tax cuts and as Amazon demands handouts from cities around the country competing for headquarters, or Amazon's case, headquarters, their second headquarters. Big business and the right wing fight back within day. All right, before I get into that, I want to get into what was just mentioned. So what happened with the campaign is another thing we have to sort of teachable moment thing is, you know, Seattle is a sort of called a progressive city. And so the Democrats dominate the city council in Seattle, and they're considered, for the most part, progressive Democrats. And some of them are even, you know, more progressive than others, quote unquote. Now, I use the word progressive in big bunny quotes or whatever that is, you know, big quotations, because what we have to understand about the Democratic Party is progressive 1 second, establishment the next. That there's a very fluid line between Democratic Party politicians that are doing left populism, like Sanders, for example, and then what actually happens in the next moment for a vote or whatever. So that we've been burned, we being working people involved in movements with Democrats, burned again and again and again and again. And for someone like me, who's been active for a long time, and for a lot of socialists, it's just like a cliche by now that the Democratic Party is corporate dominated. And even if you go in as an individual with high ideals and so on, and claim you're progressive, even some Democrats claim they're socialists, which I completely reject. You can't be a socialist in a capitalist political party, in my opinion. And you have to have some sort of baseline definition of socialism. And I think that is you're anti-capitalist and you're not in a capitalist political party. That's my personal definition of what a socialist is. Now, there are people that would disagree with me, even people in Socialist Alternative, who would say, well, if someone says they're a socialist, they go in the Democratic Party, they bring up certain demands, you know, we're going to call them a socialist. I completely disagree with that. I think that's very unscientific and very un-Marxist.
They might be doing, you know, it in good intentions, but still, they're already in the pockets of, like George Carlin said, the big league that says we don't get an F about you, we don't get
right,
a,
right.
At the end of the day, all your representatives, all your progressives, all at the end and already bought up, you know,
I agree.
In the pockets of big business.
I agree. And once you're in the Democratic Party, you're in a different world. You are. If you want to keep the anointed status from the elites in the Democratic Party, meaning keep the money coming in, the propaganda coming in, the networking, the participation on getting legislation passed, all the things that come from being in this little club, even on the local level, you got to play by the rules.
It's like Training Day. Remember the part when Denzel Washington goes to the Big Four?
The wise men. I remember
the wise men, right? Remember that part?
Oh, I like,
these are the ones that actually, before I even do anything, I have to go to them first.
Exactly, exactly. And that's real. And I love that movie, by the way, because it came out right after 9/11, and the country was immersed in the big business and government assault on our minds, basically, and there were flags everywhere, and you know, acute nationalist paranoia everywhere, and in my opinion, not a proper response to the terrorist attacks. You know, not you know, turning it into a invasion of Iraq, and they didn't even invade. You know, it was Afghanistan
Libya,
first. You know,
Syria,
and yeah, the whole thing, yeah. On woe from there. But anyway, the point is that Training Day comes out, and it's just totally, like you're saying, it's a metaphor for power politics in the United States. You know, corrupt cops, corrupt politicians, the whole thing. And someone going in, the Ethan Hawke character, going in to be the savior, you know, like so many people go into the Democratic Party and they disappear into the system because it's corrupt. Democratic Party is a corporate political party. I remember being in the theater, and there was a little unease there. There were some people like me that were like, wow, this is great, you know, and clapping at certain scenes. But there were other people that just got up and walked out. And the crowd I was in was mostly black. The crowd, you know, because the
that walked out?
Director's black. I'm going to get into that. Director's black. Denzel was the star, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so the crowd was mostly black, and I was loving the movie, and a lot of people did love it. But there were people that walked out, including some black people. And because, you know, I mean, we don't want to generalize, you know, I think in general, among progressives and activists and among the general population, a lot of black people face, you know, special repression from the cops and so on. And so they have a higher political consciousness, a little more doubt about the propaganda and the mythology and so on, obviously, because of racism and so on. But there are also conservative black people. I mean, there's obviously
like the Black Panther one, the guy who wrote the Black Panther.
Yeah, he I always mess up his name. Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Yeah, the one that
he's conservative
with West. What's his name? Refuse any kind of intellectual
Cornel
back
West
and forth.
Debate. Yeah, he wouldn't debate Cornel
that's
West.
It.
So obviously, there's a whole spectrum of political belief among black people in the United States, among African Americans. In fact, I was just reading about housing issues. I don't know if we'll have time to get to this. And of course, Trump has that token sort of black administrator over housing now, Carson. And he just really screwed over a lot of black people, a lot of African Americans, a lot of people of color, and a lot of other people through cutting housing subsidies.
All they care about is
public
green
housing.
There's no color.
I know. So anyway, the movie was a breath of fresh air. That director is a very interesting director to me. I like his work. And yet, Figueroa, another name I mispronounced.
Spanish guy.
No, he's black. No? He's black.
Oh,
Antoine,
okay.
Antoine Figueroa. I used to know his name well, believe me. he's a very interesting director. And he went for it with that movie. He was like, you know, there's no good guys here, really. And what he did also is he showed that within the bad guys, there's still some sort of code of honor somewhat in some certain places. And
you know who was the good guys in my opinion towards the end of the movie?
Yeah.
The people in the ghetto.
That's what I'm talking about right now. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Yeah.
He goes into a...
The people that said, no, I'm not... enough with this guy. He shot him in the butt.
Yeah. Denzel's character...
He shot him in the butt. Bam! He's like, oh, yeah? You know, they didn't do anything. He's just kind of like,
right. That was realistic, too. Like, they didn't attack. They let the cops...
We're with this good cop here. You know,
The cops fight it out, too. Remember that?
Yeah.
And they didn't get involved because that's too dangerous, you know? This was a completely ghettoized community where... And very, very poor. But it had this, like, network, you could tell. The film shows it. And I'm not trying to romanticize. It was probably run by gangs, but they were also victimized by this corrupt cop on a regular basis. And he had an apartment there, right?
And, with his girlfriend.
Yeah, his girlfriend.
Salvadorian
even
girlfriend.
Even though he was married, right?
No,
apartment on the side.
And he had a kid with him.
Yeah.
With her.
Yeah.
So it was very, very, like, very for me, I was like, it's movie.
Well, a lot of great characters because, you know, the kid is an innocent victim. You see, he could have a great future. He's going to get stuck there. You see the corrupt...
He had more trust with he had less trust with his dad than
he
did
his dad
with,
was violent,
with
you know?
The cop, the good cop.
And it was also Denzel Washington who is I think, rather conservative politically. I'm not sure about that, but I've heard that in real life. But he plays, he had the guts to play a bad guy, you know?
Yeah, because he never played it well. Up to that point, he really wasn't. Yeah,
he plays a lot of heroes.
Like Malcolm X what's the other one? Devil in the Blue Dress was one of my favorites. Yeah. Easy.
He's a great actor, but politically, whatever. But he took this role where he's like a real bad guy, but a bad guy with the director's view of a bad guy that exposes the system.
Yep.
And I remember this one scene too that was really disturbing. Remember the they roll up on, they're in their cop, their unmarked cop car. They roll up on a girl getting raped, basically. Yes. Although she doesn't, but it's almost. And these two homeless guys are doing it, and the Ethan Hawke character runs out and gets in this huge fight, and the other character
to save her,
Denzel, just watches. Yeah, and he does save her. That comes into the plot later. I won't get into that. And it's called Training Day, the movie we're talking about from 2001, I believe. And he ends up getting the initiative in the fight and subduing the two homeless guys. Denzel comes over, convinces him to let them go, because what's going to happen to him anyway? Denzel works one of them over, and
does he ever?
That was torture. Oh. Yeah, it was horrible. And so those are horrible things, right? Letting the guys go and torturing one of them. But the next thing was really horrible, because as they're walking away, you see the homeless guy still taunting Ethan Hawke. Come on, you know what I mean? So I was like, geez, you can't beat it out of people. You can't terrorize people. It's just conditions. It reinforced like sort of this element of Marxism for me that, you know, it's the conditions have created monsters, and you're not going to eliminate the monsters through violence. You just can't. I mean, you have to defend yourself.
Or even prison.
Yeah, exactly. You have to defend yourself, but mass incarceration doesn't work. Just perpetuates the problem and worsens it, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, we're getting too much into that maybe, but back to Amazon. If you listen to the show, you know that we riff on stuff. Yeah. So anyway.
Next will be Young Karl Marx. Have you seen it yet?
Hold on. Have you seen it?
Yes, I have.
Okay, stop. We have to have a whole like little thing on that.
Yeah.
And later in the show.
Okay, definitely.
But I don't want to get into that right now. I really want to hear about it.
Yep.
So let's not forget about that. And in case you just tuned in, you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talking music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. Your hosts are myself, Jeff, and
Diego.
And Diego's been away a little bit, and we talked about that. And we are here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. We're talking about our goals with this show are to give you alternative information from a socialist standpoint, et cetera, but also to encourage you to get involved in the socialist movement that might not be really obvious, but there is one, and it's growing, and people are interested in answers more than lesser evilism, tweedledum, tweedledee politics with the Democrats and Republicans. They're interested in more than single-issue politics, interested in more than NGO band-aids. We are about fundamentally transforming the economy to a socialist economy on a world scale where people would democratically network and vote and decide on what's to be produced, how to produce it, and then how to distribute it, how to produce it so it's sustainable for the environment, and how to then distribute it for human need to the people, not for profit, not for human greed. And that's very important, and that's a very the capitalist economy in many ways is already set up for that. It's mass production, socialized production on a world scale, but running into all these contradictions as a result. Like, for example, immigration. There was a lot of news about immigration lately because they're separating children from immigrants that are coming to get asylum status and so on. And this Jeff Sessions, reactionary Southerner who really belongs in prison, basically. Sessions is, they shouldn't break the law. I don't want to do a Southern accent. You know, shouldn't break the law. They want to come here. Yeah. Blah, blah. And,
what?
I mean, it's just horrible. It's just horrible. And he is running the show with the Republicans and the also with some bipartisan support because they're all trying for an immigration bill. This is the point I wanted to make. I haven't heard any answers from anybody. You're not going to hear answers. Solutions to immigration under capitalism, because capitalism still to this day, even with multinational corporations, rests on the nation state and the power of armies and police forces based on nationalities, and using those to get market share, to get raw materials, to get to you know, get cheap labor. Neocolonialism, in effect, you know, to not going and settling, but going and controlling poorer countries to enrich yourself, you know, in the capitalist countries, in the industrialized countries,
like Central America,
Africa, Central America, parts of Asia. But even when it comes to like China, which is a very interesting hybrid of state capitalism, but also they've kept the wages so low that there are still companies there exploiting low wages and lack of environmental regulations from other countries, U.S. obviously. Remember, Trump was recently trying to pump up this Chinese corporation and stuff like that. They see China as a big market.
Now he's at war with them, or tariffs.
It goes back and forth.
Tariffs.
Yeah. But then they also are moving production.
And now Korea.
From China to places like Thailand, Vietnam, Philippines, Indonesia, you know, et cetera. There's plenty of cheap labor.
Oh, now he's trying to go North Korea. He said, you know, that's the whole thing behind
that. They want to exploit North Korea as a new capitalist formation. And it's not, a lot of people think North Korea is Stalinist or even communist, and they dropped that a long time ago, basically. And their philosophy is not even twisted Stalinism, which isn't really socialism, and it's not socialism or communism. It's just some sort of nationalism based around the leadership, you know, the great leader and all that. And they are ripe. They've already got capitalism. A lot of people don't know this. There are capitalist companies functioning in North Korea right now from China and other countries in order to use the cheap labor there. Cheap, compliant labor, which is just all they want, really, in a lot of countries, whether it's Bangladesh or North Korea, you know. And So under immigration, using the nation state both as an exploiter and as a sort of boundary to keep cheap labor in, that is not going to go away under capitalism. It's not going to happen. And you might end up having they use the UN in various ways. But again, the power in the UN is still based on the nation states. You know, the eight powers or seven or eight powers that have veto power, they control. The United States really is the controller in the UN. So it's all based on the nation state. And if you have the nation state, you're not going to be able to have open borders, and therefore there's going to be constantly immigration problems. And tomorrow, it might not be Mexico and the United States. It might be, it's just happening in Europe, migration from Africa. But it could happen in places you don't expect, like China might get a wave of migration from North Korea or something, you know, or Canada might get a bigger wave of migration than it's already experienced from some other place that becomes poorer or something, you know. For a while, Ireland was a big wave of migration to the United States in the 80s, you know. Then they just basically rewrote their tax laws and everything, so they had big corporations come in. And invest in Ireland, and there were more jobs, although they were very low wage, and that's going to all collapse at some point. But what I'm trying to say is there's different places of, you know, outbreaks of this, and capitalism has no solution, because they use it in a way. I mean, obviously, there's plenty of big corporations in the United States right now that use immigrant labor. They use the threat of deportation as an added club to keep places non-union or compliant and exploit. I mean, there's plenty of places that will hire only like Latino workers or only Asian workers or only African workers or whatever, and that's deliberate, you know. And I don't blame the workers at all. They gotta mm-hmm. survive. People have to survive. But deliberate policy to use immigration policy against the labor movement, against workers. And so I was just thinking on the way when I was hearing all this stuff on the radio that there's just no way out on immigration under capitalism. Now, if they do a temporary amnesty, we would support that, right? But it's not going to solve anything, you know, because there's going to be another way.
I came in under that.
Yeah.
In the 80s, under Reagan.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. And look what's happening now. And the history of immigration, which, you know, we don't have time to get into too much, but the Braceros program and all that, there were times when they would, quote-unquote, welcome immigrants as cheap labor. And then there were times where they kicked them out. Like in the 30s, during the Depression, they went after Mexicans like crazy in the Southwest, sending them back to Mexico, probably whether they were citizens or not. I don't know for sure. I have to double-check that. You know, they were using the Japanese, you know, as cheap labor for a while.
Couldn't the Mexicans say, wait a minute, my ancestors have been here. You took over our land.
Exactly. Yep.
Technically.
They could say it. That's what I'm talking about, the nation state.
Will it fly?
The nation state, the essence of the, no.
Will that stick?
Engels said that the essence of the nation state is special armed bodies of men. When you reduce all the laws, how do you enforce laws? How do you enforce any regulations? It's got to be based on, under capitalism, it's got to be based on coercive violence, which is embodied in the army and the police. So, yeah, you can say the truth. Hey, this was part of Mexico. You stole it. Or just like Native Americans can say, look at this. We're in reservations. What? What? What is this? This is crazy. Yeah. You know, we didn't even have ownership. We just went where we wanted, you know, or we went where we had our tribe or whatever, you know. And you can say whatever you want, but unfortunately it comes down to power. And the power is, people think it's political, and it is. I don't want to be simplistic about it. It's not just the power of the gun. The power of the gun is intertwined with a certain political party, backed by a lot of stuff, you know, like you're saying, like the propaganda, the religions even are used, and people are used. You know, people are taught that, you have no way to survive unless you fight this other group of people. And it's really like, no, wait a minute, I should be fighting you. And that's the essence of wars under capitalism. But getting back to Amazon, another digression, but a good one, I think. Getting back to Amazon, and it is related to this, if you connect the dots, is we're talking about power and wealth. Amazon, by the way, the most powerful corporation in the world right now, or number one or two. Jeff Bezos, the head of Amazon, is the richest person in the world, or is second richest? Again, I'm not sure. I don't have the... They're in the top two anyway, in both of them. So what happened with... what I started to get into earlier is what happened with the process of, while we're doing the coalition, street mobilization, bring people to City Hall thing, which is, again, very labor-intensive, knocking on doors and stuff, the way the big business fought it was through the Democratic Party. And they got the Democratic Party to, at first, oppose it just completely. And then as the movement grew, this is all within 9 months, Democratic Party, for the most part, representatives in Seattle, they then came to say, well, okay, we could be for some sort of tax. And they watered down our initial proposal twice. They lowered the amount. And it finally got down to the amount that passed temporarily, $48 million. It was $150 million. They watered it down twice. And they also put what's known as a sunset clause. Did you ever hear that formulation, sunset clause?
No.
So that means that puts a time limit on it. And after that time limit hits, it either is repealed or you have to reconsider it. And in this case, the law, which was going to just last as long as there was support for it, as long as the counter law didn't come in, they put a 5-year limit on it, the Democrats. Now, so our situation was, we voted against that each time, and we argued against that. But then finally, when all the Democrats then, with those clauses, said, okay, we'll pass this, we said, well, do we accept the $45 million or nothing? And we decided to go for $45 million and went along with it. So we tried to stop the watering down the sunset clause. And Sharma had a great quote. She said, any reform under capitalism has a sunset clause attached to it, which is the absolute truth. You know, you could have anything you think is your right under capitalism. Like, a lot of people running around thought pensions were their right, and they don't have a pension now, and it was stolen from them, or there was never existed, you know? You could, people that think they have a right to, a job they've been in for 30 years and then they get laid off. You know, I see this all the time as a union representative. I've been a union representative, a shop steward many times in two different unions. And everyone thinks there's these laws out there protecting them. Not everyone, but a lot of people think there's laws out there protecting them for really bad stuff that happens. And I wish it were true, but there isn't. There's no law that says you have a right to a job in this country. There's no law that says you have a right to a house. There's no law that says you have a right to an apartment. There's no law that says you have a right to live. There's nothing in this, you know, live as far as livelihood. Mm-hmm. There's nothing. And I even had a job once. I think I told you the story. I was right after college, right after I left the country and came back. I was a paralegal doing unemployment law. And I represented this guy who got totally messed over. He was innocent. But I usually won these cases, too. But this was one I lost, even in appeal. A bus driver accused of smoking pot. Back in the bad old 80s, you know. And pot's still an evil thing to people like Jeff Sessions, right? So this guy was accused of smoking pot based on circumstantial evidence. They smelled pot in the bus. Well, that could have been a passenger.
Oh, today it's anyone. You can walk down the street.
It could have been a passenger. Yeah. It could have been a passenger. It could have been something in the air. And I don't trust management. And this guy said, no, he didn't smoke. Et cetera.
Did he do the drug test?
And it was the end of his route. I don't even know if they had the drug test back then. But no, that was that's not, common that was sense. Not, that was not where's part the of the test? Evidence. Well, there you go.
Because it's in your system for a long. If he's in under, it's going to come out. If it's not, but fine.
I got to tell you, though, this is 1984 or 5. I cannot tell you the facts of the case anymore. I'm sorry. It was too long ago.
And today, all I remember is
the general stuff.
I had a friend who's a one of the guys at the trolley.
Uh-huh.
Good old friend of mine. Used to always stop by the pharmacy because I take the E-line all the time now to go to work.
Yeah.
He goes, oh, yeah. They'll come up to you and be like, piss in a cup, just like that, randomly.
Oh, I hate that.
Yeah. Just like that, piss in a cup.
Well, what I'm telling you is...
May or may not happen, but it happens.
What I'm telling our listeners is that in this case, I'm getting to a point that doesn't relate to the legal case. I'm sorry. So I'm taking a while to get there. But I just want to say in passing that the only reason we lost the case was that the MBTA showed up with 3 or 4 lawyers. And it totally intimidated the hearing examiner. It was just a civil service guy acting like a judge. And he never saw that kind of legal power before against me, a paralegal. And he just didn't care what the facts of the case were. He just was like, I saw it in his eyes. It's like, this is over, man. And then I appealed it. And usually I won appeals. I always won appeals except that case, actually. Because then you could just use the transcript of the hearing and the facts. And there were no facts. There weren't compelling facts in this case. But again, somebody passed the word up. This is the MBTA management. So this guy got screwed, and this is the point of the story coming up. He comes back to my office. He says, well, what do I do? And he's like, was in his 30s. He's black, and he goes, what do I do? I got nothing, you know. And I go, well, let me check into it. I don't really know. I said, I don't really know what's available for social services, and I'm going to do some research. And I did good research, talked to people in the buildings. There's other nonprofits there. And so I was working for the National Lawyers Guild. And guess what? If you're a male between 18 and 48, I think it's still this way, but I'm not sure. I'd have to double check. At that time, you got access to nothing. Even food stamps didn't kick in for some reason.
18 to 48, you have access to nothing. You have to be 48 and beyond to
receive something. Yeah, and also you have to be a woman. And I'm not, of course, you know, I'm saying nothing against the modicum of social welfare. I'm just saying there was nothing in the social safety net full of holes for males.
Being a single male, 1848, and you're not a woman, basically. Yeah, we are out on a...
For some reason, he couldn't even get food stamps. I don't remember why that was. And I was so sad about that. I was like, and you know, I was already a socialist, but just new to socialism, you know. And I was like, wow, this tells me a lot. You know, that I understand why there's a lot of homeless people out there now. You know, more. I understand more about that.
Do you see the dialectical right there? Yeah. Right off the bat.
And it's still, you know, what... And this was before Clinton, when Clinton eviscerated welfare by throwing it back to the states instead of having it federally funded. You know, remember ending welfare as we know it?
This is the Reagan era, but
I'm saying it got worse under Clinton. And so now I'm not sure what the deal is with the nuts and bolts of every last social welfare program. I wish I knew. I haven't done the research lately, but I would bet it's under Trump it's getting even more narrow. Like that thing we just said with Carson and public housing. I'd like to find that, but it would take me a minute.
We'll do it during the break.
Anyway, back to Amazon. So my point under Amazon was the Democrats really watered it down. Finally voted for it reluctantly, and they were so nervous that the mayor, who's a Democrat, said the day after the tax passed, or soon after the tax passed, said offered a tax, some sort of thing to Amazon that would ameliorate the tax. Like she was going to give some corporate welfare to Amazon. I don't think it passed. And then on top of that, it was discovered that Amazon had given her money, campaign money. Democrats take the corporate money. When Ginger Jensen, a member of Social Alternative, ran for city council in Minneapolis recently and almost won but didn't quite win because there's that tiered voting thing where you preference voting, which people think is progressive and it really isn't actually. Preference voting, she won the initial election, but then through preference voting it came back in. The more conservative candidates got elected, they being Democrats. And one of the Democrats that had been, ironically, a housing activist that we worked with, actually, in Minneapolis, when it came to running for office and running against Ginger, which he shouldn't have, he said, in a press conference and privately, he said he would accept corporate cash. Democrats, you know, doing the Democratic Party thing.
And he was with us?
No, he was... He was a housing activist that years before, a couple years before the campaign, mm-hmm. we had been involved in anti-eviction work in Minneapolis. And he was one of the main activists in that. So he thought he would cash in on that through the Democratic Party. He's going to have his new career now. He got elected, by the way. And the first thing we said to him, we knew his...
Democrats are activists for careerists, kind of.
We knew he wasn't... Well, I don't know if the housing activism was careerist, but it certainly he turned it into that. Because we knew he was suspect because, A, he was in the Democratic Party. B, he went on his vacation to Mexico before he didn't start campaigning until a little bit, like in the middle, like he was a little overconfident. And then he's like, comes in and says, yeah, I'll take corporate money. Why not? What's the big deal? You know? So, back to what happened with this Amazon tax, which, by the way, has been in the corporate media a lot, but it's very, very distorted in the corporate media, which is why I want to go into details here. So, within days, I'm quoting again the article by Calvin Priest and Keeley Mullen. Find it at socialalternative.org. Find it at counterpunch.org. Within days of the passage of the tax Amazon ordinance, big business funded groups and launched a ballot referendum to repeal it. So, put this in your head now. We just passed a law that's popular, or that there was a movement for in Seattle, right? The next day, within days, a referendum pops up, totally funded by big business, to repeal the law. And it's this modest tax on Amazon and the top three corporations, Starbucks, Amazon, a few others. So right away, they had already raised $350,000. So it was like they had this already planned, you know what I mean? Big business. So in addition to paid signature gatherers, they paid people together. Big businesses being assisted by conservative, not in my backyard groups like Speak Out Seattle, who regularly employ anti-homeless and right-wing arguments, as well as far-right forces like Patriot Prayer, whose local political candidate Joey Gibson announced his support for the referendum. So this brings up something that was really horrible about this, which they talk about here. Financial backers of the anti-Amazon tax referendum read like a who's who of big business and the super rich in the wider Seattle region, with Amazon, Starbucks, multi-billionaire Paul Allen's Vulcan Mega Development Company, and wealthy developer Howard S. Wright III, whose family owns the Space Needle in Seattle, putting up some of the largest contributions to this referendum campaign. Labor unions, spearheaded by Working Washington and joined by housing activists as well as Social Alternative, are waging a decline to sign campaign in order to try to defeat the referendum before it gets on the ballot. So then he goes on to explain why big business is so enraged about this tax and so on. And I like, it's a very good point here, in part because our movement's victory bucks the overwhelming trend over the past decades of growing inequality, the slashing of taxes on big business and the rich, and the ongoing shifting of the tax burden to working people. I make these points a lot in political discussions that if you listen to the corporate media, which most people do, unfortunately, I'm not saying you shouldn't, but I mean, it's of course, they're there to brainwash you partially, but you have to get information too, so whatever. What I'm getting at is that there's a lot of people that are convinced that raising taxes is per se in the abstract a bad thing because they've forgotten the idea or didn't know that there's this thing called progressive taxation where you tax the big corporations and the super rich and not workers. So now taxes, according to liberals and conservatives, whenever a tax comes up, sound like we're all in the same boat. Yeah. And we're not. We're down in the prison hold, right, in the boat, and they're up, you know, on the yacht deck. You know, this is not in the same
like
boat
Snow
at all.
Snowpiercer.
Might be
they're up front. We're in the back eating
exactly
pool.
Exactly like Snowpiercer. We may be on the same train. But
out if they invite us to the front because they might be shooting. They might shoot us.
They're saying where the train goes, you know, and where the boat goes. And anyway, so you get the point that the idea of taxing the big corporations, the super rich, has somehow gone off the table in the corporate media for the most part, in political speeches by Democrats and Republicans, you know, and they don't want to touch that the tax thing. And when they do, the few times it comes out as very, like, really, like, narrow taxation. Like, right now in Boston, they want to tax Airbnb people, the people that rent out. Well, okay, all well and good. Why don't you tax the big corporations, though, you know? And if that's something the city supposedly can't do, why don't you fight to change the law or get the state legislature, which is all Democrat, just like the city council, to change that? And they won't do it. So, and also, you listen to, like, you know, liberal media. Like, there's a show with... Greater Boston, is that what it's called? Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan or something like that. They're really these centrist, horribly conservative people in a lot of ways. And so there's going to be a millionaire's tax on the ballot in Massachusetts. And I think they were talking about that or the Airbnb tax. And they're like, and then Browdy comes in with, oh, what they should not lower the sales tax. Now, lowering the sales tax would help working people. We're for lowering the sales tax, but we're mainly for
back
taxing.
Back to 5%?
Mainly for taxing big business, you know? But you see, his first inclination is to spread it out to the workers, you know? To because somebody's proposing a cut in the sales tax, he's got to attack that, you know? And he was used to be head of, like, this pro-tax thing, and, you know, the whole idea of progressive taxation is just gone now, for the most part. And this Amazon victory put it back on the table, put it back in the airwaves. To a certain extent, they still, you know, as you'll see, they got rid of it quick, but they also distorted it in the media. But this bucked that trend. The central tenets of the neoliberal consensus have been embraced by Republican and Democrat leaders alike, that there can be no slashing of that there can be no tax increases on big business and the rich, growing inequality, tax burden on working people. Rather than just defending the endless tax on workers' living standards, working people in Seattle, with this Amazon tax, turned the tables on the billionaire class to score a major offensive victory. As with the $15 minimum wage opposition to the Amazon tax, as with the $15 minimum wage opposition to the Amazon tax has been fueled by distortions. In talking to signature gatherers, Socialist Alternative members have heard outright lies. This is when they were getting a referendum going, the big business referendum, to repeal the tax. Outright lies like the claim that the tax had already gone into effect and that Safeway, a local grocery chain, had already closed two stores. There were other lies floating around, too. There's actually a video on YouTube about this where they were also saying to people that your taxes would go up, like a workers, a students, you know, and it was a complete lie. That's not part of this tax increase at all, which is why they hate it so much, the big business. And there was also this thing that happened that was really sad. One of the building trades, the iron workers, were working on Bezos' tower, and Bezos stopped construction as a way to terrify them. And it worked, at least with the leadership, and they got their own members to come out to have a counter rally, to a rally for the taxation. It didn't actually stop it, but it was a nasty thing, you know, and it made a propaganda coup for big business. So when polling data came out later, even after this had passed, it was okay, but it wasn't great, you know. It should have been even better. So anyway, it talks about the referendum some more and talks about how to defend it. And in the weeks leading up to the final vote, Amazon sent a brazen threat to Seattle workers, promising to halt construction. This is the thing I talked about. Held 7,000 construction jobs hostage, etc. Let's see. Housing activists and socialists first put this issue on the table last fall. We protested and occupied City Hall overnight and brought our fight for affordable housing and homeless services into the November City Council budget hearings. The original business tax proposal introduced by Shama Sawant was ultimately voted down by a majority of Democratic politicians. In the 6 months following, our movement continuously escalated the struggle with rallies, marches, attacks at Amazon Town Hall meeting, and again packing City Council chambers to bring maximum pressure on the political establishment. That's a key part of this article. This is how we operate on everything we do. We use electoral politics, Shama's position as a city councilor, as a platform to organize, to publicize, and to organize things. It's a very good method. And even in the final weeks before the vote, big business and their purchased politicians like Democratic City Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin furiously worked to water down the legislation. Durkin, the Democratic mayor, put forward a counterproposal dubbed by housing activists as the Bezos-Durkin deal after Amazon CEO Bezos and Mayor Durkin that cut the proposed $75 million tax nearly in half to $40 million a year after it was previously cut in half from $150 million to $75 million. That's what I was referring to earlier. It added the other corporate loopholes such as the sunset clause, which we talked about, to require renewal of the tax in 5 years and a redirecting of the majority of funding to temporary services, which will include inhumane homeless sweeps rather than building permanently affordable housing, etc. Now, so it went through, not as great as we wanted it to be, but still a victory, still would have brought $49 million for the next 4 years each year into building some public housing and into some services for, and we knew it, for homeless people, we knew it needed more, but then guess what happened? Did you hear about this? Did you read about this yourself?
No.
Okay. So, within a few weeks, so this referendum thing is happening, and we're starting to expose the lies. We're starting to build a campaign against it. And all of a sudden, the Democrats, we found out, met in secret on the city council, and they showed up one day with a quick vote, repeal the Amazon tax. They hadn't even told Shamus while they were planning this. And they rammed it through. And that's created some problems. They got what they wanted initially. There's no tax on the boards right now, on the table right now. But they did this without... they violated open meeting laws in Seattle. They did it so secretly, and they exposed themselves as the Democrats for the pro-capitalist and pro-business people that they are, except for one Democrat.
So did the same mistake with the whole you can't come to the...